From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 53, recorded Wednesday, February 28th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott and Carl discuss techniques for hiring engineers.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin. You're listening to Hansel Minutes from HanselMinutes.com. Scott and I are here this week to talk about hiring and interviewing engineers.
Yeah, this week there was kind of this crazy meme that was running around the web. I don't know if you heard about this, the FizzBuzz problem.
No, I didn't hear about this.
Hey, you're too busy. We're making podcasts.
That's right.
Basically, a FizzBuzz question is a question that you would ask a programmer you're about to interview. And the question is this. Here's an example. Write a program that prints the numbers from 1 to 100, but for multiples of 3, print fizz, and for multiples of 5, print buzz. For numbers that are multiples of both 3 and 5, print fizzbuzz.
Okay.
Sounds pretty straightforward.
Sure.
Apparently, there's a great, great number of people when asked this question cannot do it.
Really?
They get lost. They get stuck. And there were a number of folks talking about this. You can take a look up at shrinkster.com/MGY. And Jeff Atwood of Coding Horror blogged about this and really kind of it's an older article.
Programmers program.
Yeah, he kind of. Well, he's calling it FizzBuzz, the programmer's stairway to heaven.
Wow!
Right, because it's like walking into Guitar Center.
I've already
and saying,
written it in my head.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the issue. When he put this up there, if you take a look at his site right now, as of this recording, he's got 350 comments. Here's the really sad part: the vast majority of those are people solving the problem.
Wow.
Now, you couldn't come up with a much simpler problem than that. The point is not the problem, right? The point is if you can't do it.
Right.
So it's weird that people felt the need to spit that out, but whatever. We're programmers. You tell them that they can't do something. Like he says in his post about it being the programmer's stairway to heaven, you walk into a Guitar Center and you say, I don't think most guitarists can play Stairway.
Right.
Suddenly everyone's going to start playing it,
right,
which is not the point of the discussion.
Right.
So this is kind of turned into a larger question about, how do you interview folks? There's the famous Microsoft interview question about why are manhole covers round?
Right.
Which could mean, could be a question as an example of critical thinking and could just be really obscure. Because with a lot of these questions, once you learn it, right? Now are you clever because you remember it?
Right.
How do you interview people without it becoming an issue of trivia? Well, there was an article at Artema Developer by a guy named Bill Venners who says that here are some ideas about how to interview people. First, you want to explore an area of their expertise, right? You want to find out what is it that this person is good at?
You mean this is before the interview? Do a little research into what they claim to know?
No. Well, this could be a phone interview. This could be the in-person interview. It could be any of those things.
But you say learn a little bit about their area of expertise. Do you mean before the interview, obviously?
Well, certainly. I assume you've looked at their resume and you know that
yeah,
they're good at something.
Yeah.
My point is that rather than having a list of stuff you want them to do, here's the 50 acronyms that I need you to have.
Right.
ADO, RAWCF, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
What is it that they're really awesome at? When you talk to someone and they think that they are good at something, they feel they have an area of expertise, you may not necessarily be into them for that area.
Yeah.
But they're stoked about it. They're good at it. What is it like talking to this person as they explain something that they're really good at?
Right.
Right? Mm. I don't know much about audio. You are an expert in audio, though. So I could find out about your personality by exploring this aspect of your personality.
Sure.
Tell me all about this area of your expertise. Oh, by the way, as a small aside, there's a really funny book and a really great audiobook by a guy named John Hodgman. He's the PC in the Mac PC commercials.
Oh, right.
He's also a comedian. He's got a book called The Areas of My Expertise. It's a great book. Check it out.
Oh, that's who that guy is. I heard an interview with him on What Do You Know with Michael Feldman.
He's brilliant.
Yeah, that's and of course, he claims to have expertise in everything.
Exactly. That's why the book's so funny.
That's why it's funny. Yeah.
So another idea is to, and this is all from that Artem article, have them critique something, right? Say, you know, what is it that you don't like about C#? Or tell me why you think garbage collection is just a fad.
Yeah.
So then you can find out, are they the kind of developer who's overly critical, right? Are they going to immediately start dogpiling and kind of crapping on a particular technology? Then you can find out, are they a fair weather programmer? Then, of course, there's the standard let them solve a problem type stuff, and we can give them all sorts of problems. And I'll talk to you about a problem that I recently gave a guy that I interviewed.
And the problem with giving problems is you sort of have to give unique problems every time, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you can't just open up a book and of 50 great problems to ask, because they can just study the book.
Right. Well, and the issue with asking someone to solve a problem also is this someone who doesn't work well under pressure? Now, some people argue that, well, we are under pressure in our jobs, so you should be asked to do something under pressure.
Right.
Well, other people feel that an interview is a lot like a test, and a test is kind of an artificial thing, like it was in school. Quick, perform, tell a joke.
Right.
So asking someone to design or write code on the spot, there are many people whose personality types simply will not allow them to do that. One interesting guy named Bruce Eckel on the Artema article said he likes to ask candidates to create an object model of a chicken. Because everyone knows what a chicken is, and it kind of pushes people away from the details of the computer and lets you know if they can think about the big picture.
Well, yeah, and if they can translate real-world things into objects.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Dave Thomas on that same article says he looks for people with curiosity and presents problems, not puzzles, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I ask people about what blogs they read, what books they read, how do they become lifelong learners?
Yeah, very important.
Because it's not that you want them to be people who are necessarily working on open-source projects at night, but they should be enthused. They should be they should be stoked about whatever they're working on.
What do you say if they say, I get all my information from reading Scott Hanselman's blog and listening to Hansel Minutes?
Then the interview is over and they're immediately asked to leave.
Sorry, but you just lost due to excessive suck-up points.
Yeah, we can't have that. No, I mean, I'm just on the same journey anyway, right?
Sure.
Actually, here's a small tangent, but a kind of a funny programmer thing. This is up at Shrinkster/MH1 programmer jokes. We're in heaven. St. Peter sitting at a desk. He's checking people in. Peter says, "Welcome to heaven. What's your programming language?" Guy at the front says, "Small talk." Peter says, "All right, small talk. Room 33, please be very quiet as you pass room 6. Process is repeating itself. Welcome to heaven. Programming language. VB, room 17, but do be very quiet as you pass room 6. What's your programming language? C#, room 54. Do be quiet as you pass room 6. Why do you keep telling us to be quiet as we pass room 6? Ah, the Ruby on Rails people are in room 6, and they think they're the only ones here.
Now that's an adaption of another just regular old joke.
It's the Baptist joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you want to find out when you're interviewing people, are they religious zealots? Because not every company runs things the same. We have chosen that C# is our language, but even if someone doesn't know C#, if they're a VB.NET person, they come in, are they willing to learn our way of thinking? Whether it be programming language, religious zealotry, or the way we do testing, or the way we do continuous integration. It's a real challenge to find someone who will challenge the status quo without necessarily squashing or stepping all over the status quo. Because you don't want to incite controversy, but you do want to incite kind of commentary and discussion.
Yeah.
So is the person's personality one that will integrate with your company? You don't want them just to fall in line, unless you're explicitly hiring for, you know, wanted programmer who will just fall in line and do what I say.
Right.
One of the other things that we found looking through my comments here is that people don't like trivia tests. You know, a while back, I posted that list of what I thought developers should be able to, .NET developers could know. I think that's at shrinkster/MH2. It's just a brainstormed list of all the different things I thought the average .NET dev should know. Some of them, like what's the difference between a thread and a process, people felt were very basic, while others felt that that wasn't necessary anymore because we were working at a much higher level of abstraction.
I'd beg to differ.
Really?
Sure. I mean, you have to know what a thread is, especially in this day and age, if you're going to write code, because so much of your code that you're going to be writing in the next 20 years is going to be multi-threaded.
Well, one guy said in one of my comments when I was weighing in about this FSBuzz thing is that, you know, he knows what recursion is and he did it in university, but in his experience working for 10 years or so, he just hasn't needed to use recursion to solve a business problem.
Well, that in particular, that case is true.
Really?
Yeah, I think.
Some people are finding that hard to believe.
Well, because, yeah, you're really not writing a lot of code at that level. I mean, the things that recursion is good at is iterating through lists, like lists of directories and putting in things like schedules into calendars and
sure,
things like
sure.
that. And a lot of that stuff just, that's
right.
at the tool level.
Oftentimes, iteration can cover up recursion or do recursion, just as well as you need to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Franz Boma made that comment on the blog as well, that you can solve virtually any problem without recursion. So maybe that wasn't a good example. I think that the real question
Knowing
is...
the difference between a process and a thread is a little different, I think, though.
Certainly, certainly. And when you're looking at patterns type questions, like if there's a known computer science thing, whether it be recursion or lists or whatever, do you know when to recognize that you need it?
Yeah.
Whether you've used it or not, or whether you have vast experience in it, is very different from, is it the time? Is this the time to use that?
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of controversy about whether or not we should actually have people code at the interview. Seems to me that if you're hiring someone to sing, they should be singing at the audition.
I agree.
I don't want to find out that they can't sing on opening day. But a lot of people, a lot of companies will hire somebody, put them through training, teach them about their product. They may be at the company 2-3 weeks before they actually have learned, have actually written some code, rather. Do you think it's reasonable to pull a laptop out and say, hey, get this out of the database, select star from authors, I'll be back in an hour?
I absolutely do. In fact, I would try to make up some sort of FSBuzz thing that is simple, that obviously isn't all over the internet like that is now.
Mm-hmm.
I would certainly do that. I mean, especially given that the results of that test,
mm-hmm.
which I agree is pretty disturbing.
There was a guy named Mark Friedman on my blog who said that they give the candidate 45 minutes. They give them access to the internet, and they really do expect them to look stuff up, and they stick them in a room.
Yeah.
They want to find out if they work well under pressure. What do they do when they get stuck? And then how do they communicate their issues, and if they even try to communicate issues, right? Do they stay in the room, or do they come out and say, I have a question?
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I think it is a good idea. I think I want to implement more of that kind of thing. We have people write some code on the board, but bringing out a laptop, I think, is a good idea. Now, one point was that many developers will never do new development. They'll just do maintenance development.
True.
Greenfield file new type stuff, they're saying, is very rare. So this particular gentleman, Mark Friedman, also gives them an existing ASP.NET application. And in his case, they have both VB and C# applications that they'll give them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, here's a bug or two. I want you to go fix them.
Wow.
Let them go through the code. So it teaches them how to read code, right? Because, how do you become a really great writer of literature?
Yeah, you read all the
time.
You
read all you can. I've learned a lot from reading open source. Where else can you find just a fantastic amount of source code of questionable value and quality?
Mm.
But you don't know until you read it and until you actually take a look and find out, is this the kind of programmer I want to be? That's the kind of stuff that I think about when I see source out in the wild.
Yeah.
The other thing is to watch for the kinds of requirements questions that they ask. If you simply say, write FSBuzz, do they say, well, is this a console app or is it on the web? Is
yeah.
there a performance requirement, right? Is this working on Linux? Now, here's another one. Supportability. Who is going to support this application later? Things like that show
I would be
that
concerned
they,
if they asked me questions that they could easily Google, right?
Oh, yeah,
I
definitely.
I mean, that's like a first That's like the warning bells should be going off.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, even though I know you don't like to work blue, but this is a URL, there's a great website called www.justgoogleit.com, which you can send to people when they send you an email that says, "What's that?" And you just... So, anyway.
Yeah, I definitely do not want someone to come in and have me Google for them. So, that gets into the, what kind of a problem solver are they?
Sure.
Because you want them to self-start, you want them to work hard, but you don't want them to suffer, right? We are a team, so you want to understand that working as a group involves walking around, right?
True.
It involves talking to people. You can't just slide pizza under the door and figure that people are going to solve that problem.
Here's a question. What if you notice something like that right off the bat, and, you know, everything else about them seems to be pretty satisfactory, and yet, like, they have this one bad habit of, you know, let's say, not Googling for information that's easily Googleable. Do you say, well, they could change?
Well, so that... I have a tendency to be analogy boy, and I know I take it a little too far, but I'll give you two analogies, one on my blog, and here's a fresh one. So the first one was what I said on the blog, which was, you know, when you're trying to put together a basketball team, you want to hire tall people. So I want tall programmers.
Right.
I don't really care. I can't teach height.
Sure.
Right?
But somebody could learn to use Google when they have a dumb question.
They can learn VB. They can learn Ruby. They can learn whatever. They can learn our product. They can learn our processes. But I can't teach them to be tall. I can't teach if they're a mental giant or not.
Right.
And I would say mental giant. I'm not talking about like SAT scores here. I'm talking about they either get it or they don't.
Right.
Now, that said, there are always the kind of the Rudies and those kind of, you know, I'm 5'3", but I can still dunk.
Right.
Type of people. So these are all guidelines. The second cheesy analogy, when the question was, do you think someone can get better? Well, you know, when people get married and then they get divorced and then you hear about them actually marrying the person that they divorced.
Yeah.
I heard Larry Miller
give a good analogy of that. He says, it's like opening up the door to the fridge, taking the milk, go, ugh, this milk is sour. Well, maybe tomorrow it'll be fresh, and you put it back and close the door.
Exactly, and that totally applies from a developer's perspective. Is it your job to hire the best person for the team, or is it your job to teach someone? Well, if you're hiring an intern or a junior developer, then their basic development as a programmer is your best interest. Mm. But if someone has a title of senior engineer, senior staff engineer, while their development is important to me, they are being hired to turn or build a particular crank.
Yeah.
It's really not my job to give them the basics. There's a certain level you expect. And this is why that FizzBuzz thing, while people have felt the need to solve it and said that it's a silly question, I think the best way to phrase it is that it doesn't tell you if they are a good programmer, but it sure tells you if they're a lousy one.
Yeah.
If you can't solve a problem like that, and that's just one example, you could certainly come up with your own example, then you might not be a particularly initially talented programmer to do the basics. The idea is to lower the bar to kind of keep the chaff from coming in the door and then get down to the real programming questions. So let me interview you for a second. This is just one example. So nobody write in and say that was a crap example. I mean, maybe it was a crap example. It's just one.
Sure.
So, I like to talk about debugging problems that we've had and walk people through it like they're a member of the team and we're trying to solve the problem for the first time.
Okay.
So it's kind of like CSI, right? It's like crime scene investigation.net.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm going to hire you, Carl, and, I'll even just say, hi, how are you? And then I'll immediately start talking about the problem. And it's kind of like, oh, wow. And if they light up, then it's like, hey, there's a problem.
Okay.
Okay. So I've got an ASP application and an ASP.NET application. It's the same app. So one virtual directory. There's classic ASP and there's ASP.NET in the same app.
Okay.
It's a .NET 1.1 application. So I've gone into IIS and I've told it this should be 1.1.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is, if someone hits the ASP.NET page first, then it loads up .NET 1.1 and everything works great. But if someone hits the ASP page first, somehow the whole virtual directory turns into .NET 2.0. It gets stuck that way. And then if I go to another page after that, it's too late. .NET 2.0 is the kind of the de facto framework for that virtual directory. Where do we start to solve a problem like that?
So just to clarify the problem is that now the first place they go being the session in that session or since
the
application
came
up?
Yeah, so someone opens their browser. It's never come up before. Exactly. Good question. Not the session, but it's the very first time we've hit the app.
Okay, so it's the beginning of the application cycle.
Right, at the point where the framework gets loaded.
Okay. And if you go to an ASP page first in that virtual directory, if then you go to an ASP.NET page, the 2.0 framework is going to load.
Ah, if they hit the classic ASP page.
Just what I'm saying?
Yeah. If they hit the classic ASP page first and only, .NET 2.0 gets loaded.
That's what I mean.
They don't even have to hit an ASP.NET page.
But if they go to an ASP.NET page, 2.0 is going to process it.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. So, but if they go to an ASP.NET page first, 1.1 is going to load.
Exactly.
I would take a look at the Internet Services Manager on the machine level.
Okay.
Not at the application level. Is this a virtual directory?
This is a virtual directory set up as an application.
All right, then I would look at the application level first.
And so
I would
see it's set to 1.1.
And it's set to 1.1.
Mm-hmm. But 2.0, of course, is on the machine.
Of course, 2.0 is on the machine.
Let's say that there are no .NET 2.0 applications configured anywhere in IIS.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. That's key.
Okay.
Now the thing that I would want to do is I would want to see what's going on under the hood.
Okay.
So I would probably look at some performance counters.
Okay.
And in .NET 1.0 and .NET 1.1, just to take a look and see what's happening.
Or 2.0 and 1.1.
2.0 and 1.1.
Okay, so here's one additional information. There's a COM object that we're using on the classic ASP.NET page. Okay.
Sure.
That COM object was written in .NET.
Yeah.
Okay. So keep going.
Was that COM object written in .NET 2?
No, it was written in .NET 1.1.
Written in .NET 1.
And the ASP.NET, the ASP page doesn't know it's .NET, of course. It's just calling the runtime callable wrapper.
So is the COM interrupt layer the thing that is loading 2.0? Because
okay, so,
that's the most current version of .NET on the machine?
Exactly. That's exactly what's happening. Even if you go on the registry and look... Is that the sound of cheers?
That's the sound of cheers, yeah.
Well, we're not done yet. We haven't solved it. We know why the guy was shot, but
okay.
We don't know... We know that the guy was shot. We don't know why he was shot.
COM interrupt layer is a good place to consider when weird things happen.
Okay, so I go into the registry and I look at the prog ID for that COM object, and
okay.
I see that it's actually marked to say... .NET 1.1. It says that in the registry. It says it has the version number and everything.
Okay.
MS Core Lib, but it's just not happening that way.
All right.
What's
so
the
let's
deal?
Let's look at the machine config file, and perhaps that object assembly is getting redirected somewhere.
Okay. Good idea. Assembly redirect. So there's no assembly redirects and there's no GACing going on.
There's nothing in the GAC. There's no assembly redirects going on. Is this COM object calling another COM object?
No, it's all by itself.
It's not calling another .NET object.
Nope, it's all by itself. So the issue you've found the issue. The issue is that the COM object is loading .NET, and I'll give you one more information. It appears that registry key is completely ignored because anytime you make a COM object on a Windows system, you'll get the latest version of the framework if the framework isn't already loaded. That's just how it works. This is why we don't write Explorer plugins and right-click menus in .NET.
So the problem is that it's not looking in the registry to make sure that it's loading the right version of the framework.
Right.
That's the real problem.
And this is just a feature. It's a by design. It picks the latest version. So whoever gets in first is in. So let's think about that. Here's the solving of the problem.
All right. So now that we know... So that's what's happening.
Right.
So now let's solve the problem. Whoever gets in first... So, in other words, how can you force the COM object to load framework 1.1?
Exactly. So, now you've identified the problem. How do I solve that?
how do we force it to load framework 1.1? Well, and you built the COM object in Visual Studio.
Right.
So the COM object is a .NET object that's being called with a COM callable wrapper through ASP.
Right. We called regasm on the
regasm.
Exactly.
Hmm.
So what are some opportunities in IIS for us to modify its behavior?
Let's see. Yeah, some opportunity. I got a couple of things going in my mind. One thing is that I would want to try, because I haven't had to solve this problem before.
Exactly. This is why it's such a good question for an interviewer.
Right.
Of course, now that we've broadcast it, it becomes a crappy question. But right. This is an example of the kind of stuff that we're doing.
So the first thing I would like to do is I would like to load up the source to the object that I'm creating in .NET in Visual Studio.
Let's say it's just hello world. It's one function, hello world. There's nothing there.
Okay. Is it something that's compiled into a DLL beforehand, or is it just of course it is. It's not a VB file.
It's foo.dll, regasm foo.dll, create server.create object foo.foo.
And when it was created, when it was compiled, I guess at the command line, because you're not a Visual Studio guy, it was compiled with 1.1.
Absolutely compiled with 1.1.
Absolutely compiled.
And we talked about how
there's no way to redirect it.
No.
And it doesn't access the registry. Now, before you said it was, you had put a thing in the registry to tell it to load 1.1, but it wasn't working?
When you do a regasm, they put in there which MS Core lib, depending on what it was built with, they put in the assembly qualified name of the MS Core lib. And that was a hint to load the framework.
So pretty much I'm convinced now that it's not at the .NET assembly level.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing in the assembly that's
causing it. It's between ASP and the COM callable wrapper.
Okay.
Is what I think.
So if we assume that it's something about .NET, and I can't change .NET's behavior, nor can I get Microsoft to fix the bug or the feature or whatever you want to call it, I can only influence what I can influence.
Right.
How can I, the very first time someone hits a fresh site, how can I get
ASP.
.NET 1.1
yes.
into memory?
Well, I'm thinking about hooks. And there's a hook in classic ASP. And it's been a while since I've done classic ASP, but there's an application start.
Yeah.
That will get hooked the first time the application starts.
Okay.
Okay.
So you're thinking about hooks. That's good. But the only thing I can do in there is make COM objects.
That's right.
So what other hooks are there in ASP.NET that
that's
I could potentially use?
Well, we have hooks in ASP.NET, but those application start happens in global ASAX.
And by then, the framework's loaded.
The framework's loaded, so it's too late.
That was a trick question.
So it's too late.
So what other hooks are there in IIS proper? Older
things. Yeah, I'm thinking back.
What did people write before?
Well, before ASP?
Yeah.
We're talking an iSAPI filter.
Exactly. So what can I do in an iSAPI filter?
I've never written an iSAPI filter.
Sure. And this is the point. Most people who are being interviewed haven't.
Yeah. But
we're
talking about
hooks.
I know that that's the hook. I mean, what you can do in an iSAPI filter is essentially redirect and get control when, ASP is an iSAPI filter. So basically when there's a file extension, you can associate that with a filter, you get control before that subsystem even loads.
Okay.
So at that point, however, I'd be hacking.
Okay, that's cool. But you're getting there. So the solution that we ended up using was we wrote an iSAPI filter that watched and loaded simply called one function. It was like core bind to runtime EX. Basically, we made there's a COM call that loads the framework, the .NET framework.
Okay.
So we basically, in unmanaged code in C++, just fired up the framework.
Huh.
Once it gets loaded, it's stuck there. You can only have one framework per process, so it sticks there, and you're set. So we just have a little filter. It's like six lines of code, and it says, hey, I want the framework, and it explicitly asks for 1.1.
Man, I'm just amazed that that problem exists at all.
Dude, that problem was a problem.
Wow.
We solved it. It took a day or two, but we had smart people sitting around walking through the flow chart exactly like you and I did.
Yeah.
And none of us knew the complete solution. And it's one of those problems where you look back and you go, oh, of course. But that's the good kind of problem, right?
Right.
So during the interview process, I like to ask questions like that, CSI kind of questions, because of course you're not going to have, I mean, maybe you would, but of course you're not going to have written an ISAPI filter unmanaged thing that talk.
Right, but it's all about knowing where the points are and knowing where, you know, being able to isolate it. Right.
And then you could have used that to Google on the problem.
Sure.
But knowing that, well, I can't do it in ASP. All I have is COM available. I can't do it in ASP.NET. It's too late. Framework's already loaded. Those are the kind of things that tell me that you understand the life cycle, the lifetime of an ASP.NET application. Another example question that I offer sometimes up to people is, describe an HTTP GET from the moment it leaves your browser till it gets down to ASP and then back.
That's a good one.
Because then you find out, well, of course they don't understand the exact details of, I don't know, IIS7's pipeline or whatever, but they're not supposed to. But at least they know what they don't know.
Yeah. And then some magic happens.
Indeed. And then a miracle happens.
I think you need to be a little more explicit here. All right, Scott. What a great show. Thanks for dragging me through that. That was fun. Made my day.
I'm glad.
And we'll see you next week on Hansel Minutes.